12-11-211, Inclusive Communities Project versus Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs. Ms. Klusman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The district court erroneously found defendants liable for disparate impact discrimination under the Fair Housing Act. I'd like to spend my time today on what I think were the two biggest errors that got us to where we are. First, the failure at the prima facie stage of the district court or ICP to isolate and identify the specific facially neutral practice that caused the disparity about which ICP now complains. And second, the placement of the ultimate burden of proof on defendants to essentially demonstrate that there was nothing they could have done over the past 15 to 20 years to produce any different result. Turning first to the prima facie case, in both the employment and fair housing context, courts across the country have been clear that the prima facie case requires the plaintiff to isolate and identify a facially neutral practice that causes a disparate impact. This test originated in the Supreme Court in some Title VII cases, Watson and Ward's Cove, and the court there explained the need for this test is so that we don't create a system whereby employers are simply subject to liability because they failed to achieve some sort of racial balance. The court wanted to avoid any type of quota system or a system in which employers feel burdened to somehow use subterfuge to try and make sure that their workforce is sufficiently diverse. So you must have a facially neutral practice that causes the disparate impact. The new rules from HUD, the regulations that just were enacted regarding the burden of proof in a disparate impact case, specifically state that the prima facie burden is to identify a challenge practice that caused or predictably will cause a discriminatory effect. So you must have a practice, a cause, and an effect. And in this case, the district court found a prima facie case based on the effect alone. If we look at the district court's
counsel, didn't they have a practice of granting or denying applications for tax credits? Isn't that a practice?
That is not a practice that caused, that is not a facially, if you're
well,
referring.
I thought you just told me we got to take it in steps.
Yes,
first thing you got to, you want them to isolate and identify a practice.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that the first thing they have to do according to you?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so isn't it a practice to either grant or deny applications for tax credits? Isn't that a practice? Isn't that what this department does?
It is a practice, but it is not what is causing the disparate impact.
All right, so we got practice. You agree with me that's a practice?
I don't know that I would agree that that could be the practice in this case, because ICP has argued that the practice is the disproportionate approval of tax credits. They have made that claim, but that practice itself is not facially neutral as they described it. To be the disproportionate approval requires you to look at the race of the applicants and look at the results that you're achieving. What we have in mind when we talk about a practice is what leads up to that decision. What are all the factors that go into that ultimate decision? It would be like in an employment case regarding a fire department that had more men than women and saying, well, your practice is hiring more men than women. But the practice that really is causing the problem is, for example, a strength requirement that screens out more women than men. You can challenge that
practice.
Well,
that's not a practice. That's a requirement.
But that is the – I guess I don't want to get caught up in semantics, Your Honor.
Well,
but
I don't either. That's why it seems to me you're making way too much out of defining – what a practice is, and then you tell me you don't want to get caught up in semantics. That's what it sounds like to me. You're telling me it's a practice if the practice is that you've got a strength requirement. Well, that sounds to me like a requirement, but now you've identified that as the practice that causes the discrimination. Is that what you just said?
You have to, I guess, that you have to look at the reasons for the decision. You cannot focus on the decision alone.
Statistics alone are not enough to prove disparate impact. Is that correct?
Exactly, Your Honor. And so by focusing solely on the decisions of the board, they're focusing solely on those statistics. When we have described, there is actually a very lengthy and complicated process that goes into whether or not that decision is going to be yes or it is going to be no. And so simply saying your decision is a practice is not sufficient. We have to identify what part of that decision, what process we're looking at to make that decision is causing the disparity. And no one in this case has been able to do that. And actually, the district court, in one of the very first written decisions it made in this case regarding a standing question, so obviously a slightly different context, but on page 220 of the record, the district court stated that there were no facts alleged that suggest the existence of any independent race-neutral reasons for the disparity. So right there, the district court has said, no one's alleged that there is a facially neutral reason, yet in order to demonstrate a prima facie case of disparate impact, you must identify a facially neutral reason that is causing the disparity. One other element that ICP has suggested is the practice is this use of discretion. ICP has suggested that discretion is the practice that is causing this. The first problem with that is that ICP has never linked discretion to the statistics about which it complains. You must have that causal connection. And so simply to say there's discretion available to the board is not sufficient to say discretion has caused the problem about which ICP is now complaining. Second, discretion in this case, ICP seems to believe we have a lot more discretion than we do. There is a QAP process, there is points, elements.
Counsel, so you're telling me I got to That a plaintiff would have to argue that discretion causes the impact?
That is one of the arguments ICP has made.
Well, isn't that a requirement then that the plaintiff show intent?
It could.
You'd have to show the basis for the exercise of something which we're agreeing is discretionary. So then you're looking at the intent behind the discretionary act. And that's what you see. To not have to prove when you're talking about discriminatory impact, isn't it?
If that is the argument ICP is making, then yes, you would have to show intent. But the Supreme Court, for example, in Walmart versus Dukes, indicated that subjective decision-making processes can be a disparate impact case. You can attempt to do that. It might not be easy, but to
I extent, agree with that. It yes. just seems to me that what you're saying is that the plaintiff is going to have to establish what the basis is for the discretionary act or decision.
Yes, Your
which
Honor.
Sounds just like intent to me.
I would agree.
All right.
I would agree. And we know in this case that the plaintiffs were unable to prove actual intent on the part of the defendants. And that is, I think, one of the problems with arguing that discretion is the practice, because they have never explained on what basis we should have been exercising our discretion. They simply say, well, you should have used your discretion to make sure that you put more projects in Caucasian areas. Well, that would have required us to consider race, which is, of course, prohibited by the Fair Housing Act and the Equal Protection Clause. So it's I think the failure at the prima facie case to identify this practice sort of infected the rest of the trial, because the remaining elements of a disparate impact claim require us to focus on the practice, what is causing this problem. And then it is up to defendants to offer a justification for that practice, and then the burden should shift back to the plaintiff.
Let me ask you, why did the district court apply the Second Circuit Hunting and Branch standard instead of the Watson standard, which retains the ultimate burden of proof on the plaintiff? Because the most recent decisions in this area from the Eighth and the Sixth Circuit, both use the three-factor test that's analogous to the Title VII disparate impact, as do the HUD regulations. So why did Judge Fitzwater do it the other way?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Well, were you at trial?
My first involvement case was to attend trial, so the summary judgment order regarding prima facie case had already occurred at that point. That was being handled by outside counsel. I do believe in the orders that he made, he referenced some other district court cases, and they may have been older cases that referred to the Huntington test as opposed to recognizing that there had been.
But the Fifth Circuit has no authority on that, so we have to go to the other circuits, don't we?
You can, or you can look in this case to the HUD regulations. I believe those are supposed to apply.
For persuasive most only, but
yes.
Now I take it the state did not, since you're not arguing it, you did not preserve a claim that Title VII does not allow a disparate impact cause of action?
We preserved it in a footnote, in a couple of footnotes, Your Honor, just
did
because Magner.
Did you preserve it in the district court?
Yes, Your Honor. Again, it was in a footnote in our briefing following trial saying at that time Magner versus Gallagher was in front of the court, and we said if the court grants Magner versus Gallagher and says this cause of action doesn't exist, we want that relief. Same thing with this court with Mount Holly. We put it in a footnote saying, you know, if Mount Holly comes out in our favor, we want that relief, but we also recognize that this panel is bound by previous decisions of the court.
The other issue that I'm wondering is preserved is there's all this argument in the briefs about the quality of the plaintiff's statistics for their prima facie case. Is that error preserved by the state?
My time is up, Your Honor.
Well, go ahead and answer
it. Yes, Your Honor. We filed a Daubert motion in the district court that the district court treated as a motion to reconsider our summary judgment. We also presented Dr. Mary Whiteside at trial, who explained why the ICP statistics were not a reliable tool for ICP to be using.
Okay.
There are no further questions.
You have time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Rosenthal.
May it please the court. My name is Brent Rosenthal. I represent Frazier Revitalization, Inc., which intervened in this case after trial, but before judgment and before the court issued its remedial order. As representative of Frazier, I'd like to present a different perspective. Frazier Revitalization is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which, of course, as its title suggests, is interested in the revitalization of inner-city minority neighborhoods, but in particular, the Frazier Courts neighborhood, which is in South Dallas.
You say somewhere near the fairgrounds.
Yes, yes. The intent of the organization, the purpose of the organization, is to replace dilapidated and blighted housing that's available there with decent, affordable housing to energize and repopulate the area, which has been losing population, to attract businesses and hopefully create a snowball effect so that this neighborhood does not remain a disadvantaged area in perpetuity. In order to accomplish this goal, Frazier needs low-income housing tax credits. But this suit, the objective is to siphon off low-income housing tax credits that would be available to for projects in minority neighborhoods and devote them to relocating people in more affluent neighborhoods, which, if resources were available, would be a very desirable outcome. But these organizations, ICP and organizations that try to build affordable housing in affluent neighborhoods, and Frazier are in competition for these very limited resources.
Does the record reflect, as to Frazier's neighborhood, the before and after percentages of Caucasian and non-Caucasian?
I would assume that my opposing counsel could answer that question because he was the one who was supplying the court with the demographic data. I don't know whether the record contains that, but it's long been a minority neighborhood and is in the process through these nonprofit efforts to try to redevelop the area to improve it, but it has long been disadvantaged.
But aren't you going to point out that the tax code gives an advantage to community revitalization in distributing these tax credits?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Section 42 of the Internal Revenue Code, subsection M, and it's cited in our brief at page, or quoted in our brief at page 17 and 18, actually does create a statutory preference for projects in that are part of a concerted revitalization, community revitalization plan. And our concern, and that expresses the Congress's intent that these limited funds, these limited assets, should be dedicated, at least in the first instance, to organizations that will rebuild these blighted neighborhoods. And that should give us preference above any arguable Fair Housing Act claim.
Regardless of ethnicity?
Yes, Your Honor. Regardless of ethnicity,
I think the intent... the tax code is national. And if this were Butte, Montana, there wouldn't be a question. But in Dallas, Texas, there is.
Well, that's true. But the federal statute is neutral and, in fact, doesn't really mention race. It mentions it wants to provide assistance in low-income areas. But, and because it's neutral, we think that it should apply in Dallas equally as in Butte, Montana.
This may be a question better posed to the other lawyers who have been in the case longer, but are you aware of any other case in the United States that has challenged the giving out of low-income tax credits in this way?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a case, and I'm looking for the site right now. It is a New Jersey case called In Re 2003 Allocation Process or something like that. It's cited or discussed, actually, at pages 23 through 25 of our brief. That's the only case that we could find that comes close to discussing this competition for credits. And in that case, the New Jersey court said, we understand the desire to promote more racially integrated neighborhoods, but we are subject to the statutory mandate of favoring revitalization of communities.
All right.
That's my time. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Daniel.
May it please the court. I'm Michael Daniel. I'm with Laura Becerra, plaintiffs for Inclusive Communities Project, plaintiff and appellee in this case. I intend to cover the issue of discriminatory practice and the whether or not the prima facie case statistics were successfully challenged ever by the state, as well as answer a few questions. First question, South Dallas is and has been 90% black, Your Honor, for a long time. Since the 40s, parts of it, and since forever, a long time, where Frazier is. And when they were putting the tax credits in, it was black, too. The case of the New Jersey case went ahead and held, though, that both goals should be able to be accomplished, and they encouraged both goals to be made and pointed out that at the time, New Jersey had a separate allocation for suburbs and that it had preferences for units in high income areas, as well as revitalization. We don't see anything that is inconsistent between the two. Siphoning off, one other issue, the siphoning off resources is being discussed. There's a 1-point difference between the points under the 9% program for a application in a community revitalization plan area and an application for a unit in an opportunity index area. 1 point out of 200 points. There is, in fact, no showing that this point is going to have a discriminatory result of any kind in terms of either perpetuating segregation, it's going to be a long time before segregation is perpetuated by this remedy, or having any other kind of disparate impact.
So what are you saying, you're talking about the district court's remedy in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
The
in terms of siphoning it off, it's not going to siphon off anything.
Oh.
Okay. I mean, the areas
Well, he's entitled to his view about that, isn't he?
Well, yes, ma'am, it's his view, but there's nothing in the record to suggest how that would happen or that, in fact, it would, if it happened, whether or not it would occur.
Well, it is a zero-sum game when you're talking about a fixed amount of tax credits.
Well, Your Honor, there's two sets of tax credits, and only one of them is a
there's
fixed game.
There's the 4% and the 9%.
And the 4% have not been a zero-sum game for a long time. The 9%, in fact, may be a zero-sum game, but that zero-sum game has been weighted towards the Frazier, for example, neighborhood for a long time. There are already 8 low-income housing tax credits there, Your Honor. If that area was going to be revitalized by tax credits, it would have been revitalized. The evidence is clear. Tax credits are not going to revitalize that neighborhood. It needs a lot of work and should get it.
All right. If the district court, if we would agree with counsel's opposite, that the district court put the burden of proof on the wrong party, what do you say that doesn't matter, it's sustainable anyway?
Your Honor, because if you look at the evidence that the Judge Fitzwater discussed in great detail on less discriminatory alternatives, that evidence, some of that evidence was in the case in the beginning. Some of the less discriminatory alternatives were in the House Urban Affairs Committee report in 2006 in terms of giving higher points to high opportunity areas and a set aside for opportunity areas. That had been there for a long time. The evidence was put in by ICP. We elicited it from the witnesses. We put in the exhibits. And that was the evidence that the judge weighed and considered. He didn't just make a burden of proof. TDHCA, you didn't make your burden of proof, therefore I'm ruling against you. He did not do that.
He said he was placing, there was a two-stage proof. Yes, the first was the prima facie case. The second stage was the defendants had the burden to articulate and prove they had legitimate reasons, which you don't dispute, I believe, and that there were no reasonable alternatives, no less, quote, discriminatory alternatives. So what evidence, tying the evidence of alternatives to a probable outcome is very important in terms of who has that burden. And if they had it, he said they didn't fulfill that burden. So you have to prove, if you're going to, unless we're going to remand, as a matter of law, that you fulfilled the burden of showing that there were less discriminatory alternatives.
And we did, Your Honor. We have the evidence in there, the Tarleton report suggesting it be less discriminatory.
Tarleton is, before the current QAP, the legislature changed the standards after the Tarleton report, did it not?
Not on this aspect,
Your Honor. The QAPs change every year.
Yes.
You know, this is a moving target. We're 7 years out, and he issued his ruling just in 2012.
Well, there were others, too, Your Honor, that we put in the evidence of. In fact, not just the Tarleton report, which was there from the beginning. We put in fact, was adopted, the taking items out of the menu and putting the opportunity index points by themselves instead of submerging them in a menu of items that were also would have furthered discriminatory perpetuation of racial segregation. That came from, we elicited that testimony at trial from TDHC's expert witness, Diane McIver. She said that would be less discriminatory. They had not done that.
So, counsel, are you conceding that the district court applied the wrong standard?
No, Your Honor. He applied the standard in Huntington. In Huntington, in the Second Circuit.
And you maintain that that's the correct standard?
Well, it's the only standard that is in fact, got any kind of review by the Supreme Court. When the Supreme Court affirmed Huntington, they said, without doing the disparate impact test, we're not going to settle that question, but we are satisfied that the justification preferred in this case was not adequately carried over.
But they didn't say anything about the burden of proof. They said nothing. And a year later, in the Watson case, they came back maintaining in disparate impact in Title VII, maintaining the ultimate burden on the plaintiff.
Your Honor, and I would point out that that is a different burden than in Title VIII. For example, HUD points out that decisions themselves can be a neutral practice. And they disagree with Watson and Ward's Cove covering Title VIII, and their definition doesn't do it. The Supreme Court in Village of Arlington Heights was discussing a single decision, the decision not to rezone land in Arlington Heights. There was no question. They weren't saying that the zoning ordinance was illegal or discriminatory. They were saying that the decision not to rezone was.
Look,
the Supreme Court sent that back, and that was successfully upheld.
I mean, but the HUD regulations maintain the burden on the plaintiff.
Your Honor.
And at the stage of less restrictive alternatives, they maintain the burden on the plaintiff.
And we met that burden, Your Honor, by the evidence we put in.
Well, you did, but this is a very long and complex record, as all the argument about statistics suggests.
The arguments about statistics were never made during the summary judgment proceedings, by the way, Your Honor. All the evidence, there's two main kinds of numbers. One, the numbers of the disproportionate allocation, which was part of the practice. Okay, those were not contested in terms of their accuracy. The other three sets of numbers, which are the perpetuation of racial segregation in the distribution of the units in predominantly minority areas, where 92% of the units are, those were never contested. And there was no, the discriminatory practice issue was not raised at all during the summary judgment proceedings, ever. The only thing that was contested in summary judgment was the expert report that we were offering on discriminatory intent by Like Thompson. The judge said, I'm not considering that with regards to impact.
So
they never, the arguments
saying,
about.
May I interject,
yes,
please? So
I'm
you're
sorry,
saying
ma'am.
Their questions about the fact that the only statistics offered were Dallas City, where the injunction covers the entire DFW Metroplex and five counties, was not offered. Their complaint that your statistics only dealt with units and not projects was not counted. There was not raised their complaint that a 10% change in the assessment of the racial proportion of the neighborhoods would have made quite a significant change in the outcome of the apparent disparity. You're saying they didn't raise that?
Your Honor, none of those arguments were raised during the summary judgment
they
proceedings.
They must have been raised sometime because they have record sites for all of them.
They have record sites where they tried to bring them in. And tried to bring them in a motion to reconsider called the Doe-Burr motion. And the judge denied the motion, declined to accept the new evidence that they put in there. The evidence about the Dallas MSA was in the record, our evidence in the record from the beginning on summary judgment. We had HUD and we had the Tawfin report. HUD's numbers were in there, and they said that on the MSA from 1997 through 2003, 65% of the tax credit units went into predominantly minority areas. The next report showed from HUD for the Dallas Metropolitan Statistical Area showed that now it had been 69% of the units in the Dallas MSA were in fact in predominantly minority census tracts. It had increased. That was part of the original summary judgment evidence. Never contradicted, never contested. The Dalton report itself, when you look at it, is in fact talking about the Dallas Metropolitan Area, the vast majority. But those Talton also identifies the practice, Your Honor. It talks about discretion and it talks about a disproportionate allocation process.
Well, how much discretion is there? Because you have 10 state statutory factors and you have so-called below-the-line factors, and they end up with a numerical ranking, do they not?
And they frequently ignore and have the power to ignore that numerical ranking.
What proof did you have that they ignored? Yes. What proof did you have of that?
The entire record on the forward commitment process.
On the what?
Forward commitment process, Your Honor.
But there are no forward okay.
Yes, there are. There were three.
But they've been abolished, so that.
Well, it's not clear that they've been abolished. They're out of the QAP. It doesn't mean that they couldn't be used again, and it doesn't mean they weren't used. During the relevant period of time. And even a fraction of those units had gone into predominantly white areas, you would have greatly increased by 30, 40, or 50% the number of tax credit units in white areas in those three forward commitments in Region 3 that they talk about. You also have the QAPs from 1992 on, in the record, contained a provision that TDHCA, and the Tawfin report reports this too, TDHC reserves the discretion to not follow points and to award, and they do that. There's two examples. I'm sorry, Judge.
Go ahead.
There's two examples in the opinion where he's talking about that we didn't show discriminatory purpose. One is in Frisco where they exercised their discretion not to approve a project because it was going to have too many three bedrooms. There was another example where they exercised their discretion in Allen in McKinney County because the person getting the developer had gotten too many tax credits, not had gotten a lot of tax credits, and he was a past official at TDHCA.
Well, he didn't use that in his analysis of discriminatory disparity.
Well, actually, he does, Your Honor. He drops a footnote, and he basically says that even though this is not purpose, it doesn't mean it doesn't count for impact.
All right, so you have 2 out of maybe 1,000.
We have 14,000 units. 14,000
units. How many projects do you have?
There are 14,000 units and 79 projects in areas of crime, over-concentration, slum and blight, that they had to use their discretion to put there.
Why does projects even matter? Because a project can be 5 units or 500 units.
And we've got examples. We have one, we have one 16-unit project and one.
The financing is for projects, is it not?
No, ma'am. The financing is on a building per unit basis, and if you don't
get. It's a building. Okay, it's a building. A building can have one unit or it can have 10 units, but the bank is looking at the building, is it not?
And when the bank looked at the one unit in Melissa or the 16 units in Melissa as opposed to the 800 units in Southern Dallas and predominantly minority area, do you think they looked at it as a, without regard to those units?
No, sir, that's not what I'm saying.
And even if you take projects, they're still segregated, Your Honor. That's in the, that, I don't have
segregated is a highly charged word, as you very well know, and you also know that Congress passed the law that said we're giving emphasis to community revitalization. So you can't, there's no intentional discrimination here.
No, we're not appealing
there's
to
a comp, there's a fight between arguable goods where reasonable minds can differ, it seems to me, and there may be a legal claim, but don't call it.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was using in HUD's term in terms of the, it's perpetuating racial segregation is the discriminatory effect that we're talking about. We're not, I'm not here arguing evil hearts and evil minds. Your Honor, I'm not. Okay. It is, in fact.
But when did the state change the law to reduce the amount of discretion in the state board?
I don't think they've changed the law at all. The statute
said
is still
they
there.
They did because there was a bunch of bribery going on.
There was a point system before 2001, and there's a point system afterwards.
Well, the did they change the law to change the number of factors and the way that they were weighted?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. When was that?
That was in 2001 and 2003. And it made no difference in the distribution or the allocation of the units. It made no difference.
Well, I don't. I just want to know that it changed. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am, it changed. But what didn't change was the underlying state statute, which continued to give them discretion. What didn't change were the QAPs, which considered we can still exercise discretion to take into account over-concentration. We can take into account issues of fair housing. We can take into account issues of, and these are on all the QAPs that are in the record. We can take, and the judge cites the 2010 QAP in the decision, where he goes and lists those laundry factors for the 2010 QAP that they can use for their discretion, and he says that they could have been used as a less discriminatory alternative, by the way. Yes, ma'am. TDHC got every chance it asked for to produce a record challenging ICP's record on the summary judgment. And during the period of time and during the summary, it filed one response, got time, took depositions, filed a supplemental response. During that time, it never challenged the underlying facts of the prima facie case on which the judge ruled. Never did. Okay. The discriminatory practice argument being raised now, like many of the arguments being raised in the reply brief, were not made at, never made at trial court. The argument that it can't be a racially neutral factor because there's a disproportionate effect. Most discriminatory housing practices are going to have a disproportionate effect. What? And HUD points out that the same practice can be challenged both as a purpose and an intent case.
Would you go back and identify what is the what is the practice?
The practice that Judge Fitzwater identified from the motion to dismiss opinion, the practice was the disproportionate allocation of tax credit units in predominantly minority and predominantly whites. But that's only that's not the effect, Your Honor. The effect is the perpetuation of segregation, is the distribution of the units. That is what that caused.
To me, that's tautology. And how does it differ from Ritchie versus DiStefano, where you could define the practice as promoting more, a disproportionate number of white officers as opposed to minority officers and firefighters?
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
And that's the alleged practice because that's, and that happens to be the outcome. So you're defining the practice as the outcome. Saying it is disproportionate is the outcome, not the practice,
isn't it? The allocation was disproportionate. The choices that were made every year were disproportionate. What those choices did was perpetuate racial segregation in the distribution.
But the reason in Ritchie was, allegedly, if I may not even take right. it as a hypothetical if I don't remember it properly, but the reason was that they were ranking the officers under their test. They had to take a test, and they passed or failed the test at certain levels, and so the officers were ranked, so they operated off the test. Well, why is that different from here, where TDHC claims to be operating off a series of factors with certain measurements attached to them and making its decision based on the ultimate ranking of the measurements?
Because it's not doing that, Your Honor, and the record's clear it's not. Number one, there is no ranking for 4% projects. Two, the forward commitments were made without regard to
the ranking. You never argued against the 4%, but go on.
Yes, we did, Your Honor, and the judge says we did. They were clearly part of the whole issue. It's in the distribution. It's in the perpetuating racial segregation. That's one. The other thing is that Ritchie did not involve a specific feature of the Fair Housing Act, and that is the discriminatory effect of perpetuating racial segregation. Ritchie involved a zero-sum game there between white officers and black officers.
It's still an impact case. It was still a disparate impact case.
One, it's employment, and it's not perpetuation of racial segregation. HUD is very clear that in perpetuation of racial segregation, it cites this case.
Well, that's what's going to go to the Supreme Court someday. So if you really want to make your defense based on that issue, we'll see what the Supreme Court will say about that.
Well, right now, HUD defined this case as an example of a discriminatory housing
practice.
HUD
didn't do anything. You brought this case. What do you mean?
That's what they said in the comment. They cite Inclusive Communities Project versus TDHC as an example of an instance in which a discriminatory practice that perpetuated racial segregation.
And what's the discriminatory practice again?
The discriminatory practice is what the judge identified. It is a disproportionate allocation.
If that were so, why couldn't he have just said, from now on you do 50-50? I mean, how do you cure this problem that you've perceived? When the allocation is 50-50, when it's 30-70, when it's 10% in traditionally minority areas and 90% in so-called Caucasian areas, how do you know victory has been achieved?
Well, it won't be any of those ways, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
It won't be any of those ways. It'll be at the end of the 5 years when basically this plan that the state themselves came up with and that the state themselves are implementing on a voluntary basis on a statewide level, when that plan has run its course, and if in the meantime they have done what they can to reduce the disproportionate allocation of tax credits, then that will be victory in this case. Things will still be segregated.
You won't seek to renew the injunction if it appears that all this fiddling around with the statistics has not, in fact, materially changed the allocation of the units.
Your Honor, if there's still a disproportionate allocation of units, then, in fact, there will be a call. No, I'm not talking about on the ground, Your Honor. There's still going to be 14,000 units in predominantly black areas of slum and blight at the end of this case, Your Honor. There will be enough segregation
for
everybody.
Those are the ones that are already built, right?
Yes, there will be enough for everybody. There will continue to be units in black areas.
So you basically, I'm asking.
I'm sorry.
And we have more time, and I'm not trying to badge you. I'm asking you what I think is a realistic question, because as we move forward, all the judge said was, you tinker with this deal, you tinker with that deal, and frankly, it was somewhat confusing to me, but you're tinkering with all the little elements of this QAP, and then every year, the state's going to report to him about the racial allocation that has resulted from that every year. And what I'm asking you is, suppose you go two years down the road, and all this tinkering has not produced the desired effects for whatever reason. It may have to do with the economy. It may have to do with Texas going into sudden economic decline. Who knows? But extrinsic factors. But the allocation is not markedly different from what it is that you're complaining about. That's why I'm asking you, what is victory?
The victory would be an end to an unjustified Your Honor, the justifications are there.
But that's not a judicial answer, because judges have to be able to issue injunctive orders that have some meaning. We can't issue injunctive orders based on good feelings and the idea that something has been bad in the past. So this is a very real question to me, because I sense that, and, you know, I'm not predicting what the outcome of this appeal is going to be, but I do sense that you have achieved perhaps only a Pyrrhic victory, because the ultimate decision is not in the state's hands, it's in the developer's hands. And let's say for whatever reason, they only come forward with projects in minority areas. What are you going to do about it?
That would be.
And what will the district court do, and how will he adjust, how will he, will you move for further relief? I don't.
Yeah, first on the developers. The disproportionate allocation showed there were developers that were ready, willing, and able. They had zoning, they had land that they could afford, and they came in with applications in white areas, and they got turned down at a rate that exceeded the turndown rate for units in black areas. There were developers that were willing to do it then, there are developers that are willing to do it now. If, in fact, the disproportionate allocation doesn't change, and I think it will,
but
not in the record, we've got the first years in, Your Honor, okay? And it worked. That's not in the record. Okay? The first year worked. Right? If it doesn't work in a year, then Judge Fitzwater is going to look at it and say, what were the reasons? Did the economy go in the tank? I'm not going to hold TDHC responsible for that.
Can we hold you to...
Yes, ma'am.
You state that on the record. Okay?
I stated that on the record,
ma'am. That's good
enough. Oh, it's Judge Fitzwater.
Huh?
And it's Judge Fitzwater, Your Honor. If there's anybody who understands the subtleties of dealing with this institution, in this case, it's Judge Fitzwater, as he's shown in his opinions, and his willingness to understand and to stay out of...
Except for the fact that he arguably placed the burden of proof wrong, but, you know, that's...
Well, Your Honor, that was,
anybody can... We all make mistakes.
Well, Your Honor, there are several other circuits that do the same thing. In that case, at least had the benefit... Huntington, that he followed, had the benefit of being looked at on the justification issue.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Yes.
Ms. Klusman.
May it please the Court. Just a few housekeeping matters first. You had asked about preservation of the Mount Holly argument. I would point out that that was on page 29 of our opening brief in this case and in our trial brief, which began at page 6528 of the lower court's record. So there, those are where you would find that information. The case that Mr. Rosenthal was discussing from New Jersey is 848 A2nd, page 1. I think that case does a good job of sort of struggling with what we're doing here when you have the federal requirements set on us and you've got just trying to balance all of the interests involved and reach a decision under the Fair Housing Act. With respect to expert testimony...
So you agree it's a balance? It's a balancing act?
It's a struggle, I guess, trying to balance what the Fair Housing Act requires with the reality of trying to build low-income housing when there is this correlation between low-income individuals and race. And so if you're benefiting them over here, can you benefit, you know, just where should all of this information, all of this money go? At trial, it was very clear that there were two very different perspectives. Should you revitalize low-income areas, or should you try to create opportunities in high-income areas? Both are perfectly valid reasons, but does the Fair Housing Act require you to do them evenly, to prefer one over the other, especially if the federal government says we want you to look at these low-income areas and prefer them when you allocate these credits? There was some discussion about expert testimony. Dr. Whiteside testified at trial for the sole purpose of rebutting Dr. Thompson's expert testimony and his statistics. And Judge Fitzwater, in his findings and conclusions, accepted all of the testimony. He said, if it was an expert, I'm either accepting it as an expert or as someone with firsthand knowledge.
Yeah, but he says that you did not challenge the prima facie case after the summary judgment stage.
Your Honor, I think that... If I could just back up to what happened at the prima facie stage. The plaintiffs moved for summary judgment on a prima facie case of disparate treatment, and we moved for summary judgment on disparate treatment and disparate impact. And our goal, we said, we'll assume for purposes of summary judgment that there is a prima facie case, but we contended we won at the second and third steps. And so no one ever really briefed disparate impact prima facie case because the plaintiffs weren't moving for that because they believed at that time they had only brought.
And the judge then found disparate impact at summary judgment?
Yes, Your Honor. He found the prima facie case of summary judgment, and the only evidence he cited was the statistics and this reference to disproportionate approval, which, again, I...
But they hadn't moved for it on impact. Okay.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right.
They had actually specifically disclaimed bringing a disparate impact claim.
Did the state point it out then?
No, Your Honor.
So the state...
At that moment, we did not, in the pretrial order, we listed the prima facie case as one of our fact issues and one of our conclusions of law, that was still up for grabs. And in our post-trial briefing, we began with the question, what practice are we trying to justify here? And then going through what ICP said they weren't challenging, which was federal law, state law, and the QAP, and trying from there to figure out what exactly the practice is. So while we did not immediately attack the court summary judgment, we did attempt to carry through that challenge throughout the rest of the trial. I would also point out, with respect to discretion, Plaintiff's Exhibit 157 is a list of all forward commitments from 2000 to 2008, and not all of them are from Region 3. It's a list of all commitments throughout the state, but the only ones relevant here arguably are from Region 3, and we don't even know which ones of those are in the five-county area that was subject to the suit. And so you will see, unlike the plaintiffs have said, that they're just using discretion all over place, there were specifically 10 total forward committed projects. So that is not, and there's no link between those projects and the statistics. They don't explain it all. In fact, some of the projects were forward committed into majority Caucasian areas. So to simply come in here and say, well, it's all about discretion, is simply insufficient. I would also...
You're not denying that some discretion is involved, are you?
To forward commit, yes, Your Honor. That is an exercise
of
discretion.
Even in whether or not to grant or deny the credit, isn't some discretion involved in that decision?
I don't think so, Your Honor. If you look at
this... So we could just have an algorithm and a computer program decide who gets a credit or not, and we could save the state of Texas a lot of money, couldn't we?
That is essentially what the board does. The staff gets all of the applications. According to statute, the staff is to create a list according to the factors identified in Section 2306.6710.
Well, what are they voting on? Whether or not the formula has been applied correctly? Don't they vote?
They vote on the QAP every year.
Or not?
They vote on the QAP, the creation of the point system. The staff then applies the point system, and then the board picks the top point getters. And there's a formula: if you have leftover money, it all goes back into a pool, and you look at the waiting list, which is compiled of, again, top point getters that had not yet received projects. So if you looked at the Texas Government Code 2306, 67.10, and 67.11, it says the board shall issue the credits based on the application evaluation process that has been described in the statute. So to say that we're just randomly exercising discretion is insufficient. It is very set. You can follow along with the numbers.
Well, their argument is just the opposite. Their argument is not random.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think if you, I assume you will. I apologize, Your Honor. I am over
time.
Go
ahead.
When you go through the testimony at trial, you'll have the testimony from a developer and two board members, and they describe, and also the director of our multifamily housing, and they describe exactly how the board goes through and makes all of these decisions. And it is not discretionary. It is following the point system with small amounts of discretion with respect to forward commitments.
So what you're saying is that the discretion has to do... Now, didn't I thought... that the legislature had changed something in order to reduce the discretion in the board?
Yes, Your Honor.
When did that happen?
2001 and 2003 were the most major changes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, that's what I was... Okay.
Yes.
And the second question is, did the... he says that they had... If the burden was improperly placed on justifying the state's reasons for the QAPs... that they had evidence as a matter of law to sustain an affirmative verdict or judgment. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that or not? If we agreed with you that the burden was improperly placed to that extent, would we have to remand or is there basis for affirmance on another ground?
They have not met their burden if it is their burden. So it would either be remand or we would prefer, obviously, rendering on the basis of the prima facie case.
And what would be your reasoning for the latter?
Well, first of all, The latter being the prima facie case or the remanding?
Reversing.
Yes. Well, first of all, we have to figure out what practice we are trying to find a list discriminatory alternative
for. I know that,
for.
But going on to the...
Looking at what the district court did is it hypothesized. It said, well, maybe if you change this element of the QAP, this could have happened. There's no evidence in the record. You would expect to see, well, in 2007, there were four projects that were in Caucasian areas that were just 5 points short. And if you had given them 5 points over here, we would have had, you know, more projects in Caucasian areas. There's none of that. They don't go on a project-by-project or year-by-year analysis to figure out what would have happened if we had changed the QAP, so which they never challenged in the first place either. So...
Well, but if they said, if the judge had said it was your burden to prove that there were no less discriminatory measures, and you didn't meet it, that certainly doesn't prove that they automatically fail on if they have the burden.
Yes, Your Honor. And I don't believe that they have met that burden because they didn't go. They didn't say, well, let's look at what would have happened and just run some numbers. I mean, we've got everything is public record, so you can look at what applications made it and what applications failed. Look at the QAP and said, what if you'd given 6 points over here instead of just 2 points? Would those have bumped those high opportunity area applications into the winning number of points as opposed to being below the number of points necessary to receive an award, and that simply is not present in this case.
Okay.
There are no further questions?
I guess not.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.